Hi everyone, welcome to the podcast. This week we are answering your questions. Thanks to everyone who submitted a question over on Instagram. We are going to be diving into them and answering all sorts of things about art supplies, the artistic process, managing your mindset, and even some business questions as well. So I hope you enjoy the episode and let's get into it.
Hello Laura, how are you going?
I'm very good. The sun is shining where we are. We're in spring at the moment and it's lovely. And we've taken a bit of a foot off the gas a little bit as far as the art biz. We've been slowing down and spending time doing some gardening and other things like that. And it's so energizing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I've chatted a bit about that actually over on my Instagram, just purposely making decisions about how to slow down, like what things can we let go of. And I'm enjoying a little bit of a slower pace as we head into the end of the year. So anyway, you've been away. You're back.
I am.
On the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Back on deck.
Yeah, back on deck. And I think what we're going to be doing is alternating podcasts with you and me with artist interviews, because everyone's loving hearing from other artists. And so I think we're going to try and do that at least every second podcast. So anyway, into today's podcast, I thought that I would let you off the hook a bit. And mostly what we're going to be doing is answering your questions. And when I say your, I mean all of our lovely listeners. So over on Instagram, I did a little shout out, used one of those, features on Instagram stories. Ask me a question. And I thought that I would see what people wanted to hear about on the podcast. The questions have come flooding in, and I think what we should do today is see how many we can get through in about 30 to 40 minutes. What do you reckon?
Should be doable.
Yeah, so we might try and keep this fairly speedy so we can get through quite a few. The questions cover quite a range of topics, so we're going to be looking at art supplies, business questions, mindset, the art process, so all sorts of different things. And I'll be just answering these, I guess, off the cuff and sharing with you my own thoughts, experiences and all that sort of good stuff. I love these kind of things, Q&As, you know. So with that said, I think we should just kick off and I'm going to get you, Richie, to ask me the questions and we'll see where this takes us.
Anyone that's listening and that's on this list, you'll have to forgive me if I pronounce your name incorrectly.
That's one of the things that I always find really hard about these is the names.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to just do that at the beginning. We apologize if we get anything wrong.
So the first question is from Spain Emmy, and she asks, what art products can you not live without?
This is always a really hard question for me because I'm a mixed media artist and I like to work with a lot of things.
I was just about to say all of them.
But I think the thing that I really love is fluid paint, and that can be either acrylic paint or watercolor or acrylic inks, but I need to have something that is fluid and works with water. So that definitely is, I guess, a category of art supplies that I couldn't live without. I love my Daniel Smith watercolors. There are a few colors there that I'd have to have. And I've recently been enjoying the Matisse fluid paints. So they're acrylic paints. So I think if I had a few watercolors and a few fluid acrylics, I'd be very happy. And then I'd probably need something like a good quality watercolor paper in order to be able to play with those. So that would be a good starting point for me. And I love the Canson Heritage brand of watercolor paper. And then I'd probably throw in a pastel and a paint pen too.
I was just thinking to myself, am I needing to step in here and tell her to stop?
Yeah, so otherwise this could turn into the whole podcast episode. So what I'm going to do actually is just mention another episode, because in episode number 18, I give you the full lowdown on all my favorite art supplies. So we'll link that in the show notes if you want to hear about all the things.
Okay. Asa Falkart asks, favorite color at this moment?
My favorite color at the moment is one of those Matisse fluid acrylics. And I know the Matisse brand isn't as easily available in some countries. It's an Australian brand. I use it a lot. They have a color called Australian Olive Green. And it's just such a beautiful green. Sometimes greens can be hard to mix and get right. So I've been finding myself reaching for this one a lot. And any of my students from my classes will know that I also have a passion for another Australian Matisse colour called Australian Salmon Gum. You probably know that one too.
They all sound very familiar to me.
Yeah, so I love those colours. You know, the Australian colours in the Matisse range are very beautiful.
Bloom and Grow Workroom asks, in a recent vlog, you mentioned purchasing a set of happy brushes. What was the brand?
This one made me laugh because I was trying to think, what did I refer to as happy brushes?
I remembered why,
because they have bright colours on the end. And these brushes are from the artist Dina Wakely. And many people have been asking me about these, and I think they are a little bit difficult to get a hold of. I have never bought them in an actual art shop. I've always bought them online, and I've picked them up from various different places. So all I say to people is just to type it into Google, Dina Wakely Media Brushes. She has short-handled ones and longer-handled ones. I particularly like the long-handled ones. They are firm brushes, and that's what I like about them. There's something about the way you can push the paint around. It gives you quite a lot of control. They're very good for mixed media. They're my favourite, and they are the ones I refer to as happy brushes.
Millennial Fudge wants to know, where do you get your stencils from, or do you make your own?
So some of the stencils that I've been using recently in my work, I bought many years ago. Again, I purchased them online. I know that there are some that are from the Tim Holtz brand. I'm not too sure what the others are, but if you Google stencils, like art stencils, you'll get all sorts that come up, and you can look for various online suppliers. I've also recently got a whole lot of stencils from Stencil Girl products. I haven't used them yet, and I'm going to check them out. I'm hoping to maybe pop that into a vlog at some point down the track. So mostly with stencils, I do use ones that I purchase from art supplies shops, but you can easily make your own, and you can cut up cardboard or very thin plastic sheets and make your own stencils, which is a fantastic way to incorporate your own design elements into your art.
Okay, now there's a double up on a question here. Beverly Fay Art would like to know, what's the best way to protect our finished paintings? Do you varnish them? And Heartlights Art would like to know, if you do works on paper, how do you seal them afterwards?
Yeah, this is a question I get a lot, because when you're using mixed media supplies, it can be challenging to know what to do, because you are combining a whole lot of different things. So you could have acrylic paint, you might have watercolor, oil pastels, soft pastels, and these things all behave a little bit differently. So how to seal them can be a challenge. One of the things that I would suggest is, if you're using something like a soft pastel or even like a Neocolor 2 crayon, something like that could smudge quite easily if you don't fix it into place. So I would suggest, at a minimum, using a fixative to seal your work. And there are fixatives available that cover different things. So there are oil pastel specific fixatives, there are soft pastel specific fixatives, and there are also fixatives that are more broad. And if you look on the back of the packet, you'll be able to see what they cover. So a fixative will hold things in place, as the name suggests, fix the stuff to the paper. And then if you want to varnish it, which is going to give longer term protection, like UV protection, to make sure that the piece holds up over time. And what I tend to use for that is a spray varnish. And I have been using the Golden UV Archival Spray Varnish for many years. It does impact upon the colour of your pastels. It will darken them. So that is something to be mindful of when you are varnishing paper pieces. So I would suggest just testing things out and seeing how they look. and trying out different brands as well. So for my paper pieces, I mostly use that spray varnish that I just mentioned. When I am sealing a canvas, I use a two-step process. I apply a spray varnish for kind of the reason I just talked about, to make sure that nothing that I've used that's mixed media smudges. So I will apply the spray, because I have learned the hard way that if I go straight to using a brush on varnish, I have smudged things. Mm. And you've seen that.
Do you use a fixative on your canvas?
So I don't always use a fixative. I find that the spray varnish actually does the same job as a fixative at the end. It fixes things into place. So that I don't have a three-step process, I do just a spray varnish, and then once that's fully dry, and I just test it with my finger to make sure nothing's going to smudge. And then if I want to give it that little extra oomph, like that slightly more varnished look, then I will apply a brush on varnish. That just makes it look a little bit more, not finished, but varnishing is such a personal subject. You know, you can have gloss varnish, matte varnish, satin varnish. You can have varnish that adds to the overall effect of the painting, or you can have varnish which it doesn't really make a difference to how the painting looks. It just serves that purpose of protection. I like my varnish to kind of deepen the colours and unify the painting. And with mixed media art, because you are using different things, often you have a finish which has a lot of variation in it. So you might have some matte areas, some shiny areas, some chalky areas. And what the varnish does is ties it all together and gives it a uniform finish. So I feel like by doing that two-step process, it brings the painting together and gives it a more finished and cohesive look. The varnish that I have been using as a brush-on varnish is a Matisse brand solvent-based or terps-based varnish that you brush on, and I like the satin finish. So just to summarise that, because I'm not sure if I explained that all that well, for paper pieces, I use a fixative if I'm still sort of working on the piece, that'll hold things in place, and then I finish with a spray varnish. For my canvas or big pieces on wooden panel, I use a spray varnish first and then a brush-on varnish.
Patty Keeley, 3778, would like to know your least used colours.
My least used colour is probably yellow. I very rarely use yellow. I've got some big tubs of yellow in my studio that I have hardly ever touched. I don't really use very bright colours, like fluorescent colours and things like that. I did in the past experiment with them, but have since kind of let that go. And purple is another one. I've started to edge my way into using more purple and burgundy, and I'm actually really starting to love the colour purple, but for a long time I was not into purple or yellow.
Samia Khan Arts would like to know, how do you package your large canvases for shipping? Can you show us, please?
Well, this is a great question, and I feel kind of this is going to be a disappointing answer, because I sell a lot of my big canvases locally. And that means that we actually go drive to the home and deliver the canvas in person, or they come and collect it from the cafe where I show my work. So I'm not actually shipping a lot of my large canvases interstate or overseas. I sell them locally. I don't actually paint that many large canvases. So the ones I do, I keep them for my local cafe audience. In the past, when I have shipped more things, I have used a packing service, so I have taken the easy route, and that's just because I don't do it very often and it was easier for me at the time. So I actually used a pack and send company. I dropped off my artwork to them and they know exactly how to package things so that they do not get damaged in any way, and they are really good. Like, they do it to a standard that I just don't know that I would be able to, but they package it with loads of bubble wrap and extra layers to protect it. So that's not a very helpful answer. when I ship out things that are smaller, which I do myself, I use, for the prints that we send out, I use the flat envelopes rather than rolling them in the tube. It is a bit more expensive, but I think it's really lovely when you get a print and it's not all curled up. And the ones that I'm sending aren't that big. They're only A3. So I flat pack those and I buy the envelopes, the padded envelopes in bulk for those from the postal supply company. If I'm shipping out a canvas or a small wooden panel, I also buy the boxes that you get from the post supply company, fill them with bubble wrap or use one of those bubble wrap envelopes and put the canvas in that. So my suggestion is to go to one of those packaging places where they sell all the tubes, they do it in bulk, so you can buy huge big rolls of bubble wrap. And they can give you a lot of advice too around what to use for different things. So I would be asking questions, seeing what you have available locally to you, and then buy it up in bulk because it's so much easier if you have in your cupboard, you know, 20 of those envelopes ready to go. So that's what we do to make the process of sending out prints easier.
Karen Bree Doodles would like to know, when you use stencils on a piece for sale, are you concerned about the stencil creator's rights?
Yeah, this one had me thinking a little bit because, to be honest, it's not something I've really thought about. So my initial answer is no, I don't worry about that. I use stencils that have been created for artists to use. So I buy them from art shops and I combine that stencil work with a whole lot of other techniques and processes. The stencil is only a very small feature of the painting. I often try and push the stencil back into the art, layer other things over the top. So it is a very subtle feature. So no, I don't worry about that. And if you were really concerned, my suggestion would be to make your own stencils. They're quite easy to make, and then you wouldn't have to worry about that at all.
Brilliant. Delory Jacobson would like to know, will you talk about how easy it is for you to be in front of the camera?
This question made me smile because it certainly wasn't easy at the beginning. And all I can really say about this is practice, practice, do it a lot. And one of the things that helped me was getting you to ask me questions and then responding to those questions. And even now, sometimes you will just coax me along a little
bit.
Yeah, prompt me. And also it's helpful to feel like you're talking to someone. So when I am in the room, I'm talking to you. That wasn't helpful initially. And now over time, I feel like I'm just talking to the people that I'm making the video for. It's very easy for me to slip into that. I'm just trying to think, how did it?
Practice in your car, practice in the shower,
yeah.
Practice in front of the mirror.
Yes, that's a good idea. Like, if you're going to talk about something, when we started doing the podcast and I was driving over to the gym, and what we would do is have a gym session and then come back and record the podcast. And while I was driving over to the gym, I used to practice the podcast, like practice the intro, answer, like just speak on a topic out loud, do it in the shower. You might feel a bit crazy, but just practicing speaking and expressing yourself helps a lot. When we started, I used to have a lot of trouble just like looking at the camera. I'd find myself looking up, looking down, looking anywhere but the camera. Just reminding yourself to look straight into the camera lens is helpful. You might even want to stick something on top of the camera just to remind you, like a little sticker or an arrow, or just look here. So that you're not looking all over the place. I would start with things like Instagram stories and keep it casual, short, build up confidence in little steps. The thing that's good though with working with you is that you make me put stuff out, because I feel like if I was doing it totally on my own, I would watch a video and find fault in it and never put it out. Whereas you'll only allow me a certain amount of re-edits, or eventually you're like, this is going out whether you want it or not. So I think that you've got to get comfortable with imperfection, that it's not going to be perfect. So there's a mindset shift as well about putting yourself out there, getting over the fear, being okay with just being yourself, realizing that people connect with real people.
Yeah.
They're not looking for perfection. they're looking for someone who's relatable, that has ups and downs, that is trying to become better at something. And this is very pertinent in a way, because I was very new when I did my very first online class, and yet people have loved that class. The first class that I did was called The Melting Pot. It's still out there. We still have it on the website. I've come a long way. It didn't stop me from putting that class out there, and people would enjoy it. They enjoy seeing a real person. I would encourage people to just give it a go, practice, and put it out there. Press publish, move on, make another one.
That's the hard one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pressing publish.
Yeah.
Manish Infinity would like to know, how do you stay true to your art and commercialize it when you're broke?
Yeah, like this is a really interesting question, isn't it? Because on the one hand, we want to make art that expresses ourselves. We want to make what we want to make. But we also need to make a living. So there's this tension in a way sometimes between what we want to create and we just, you know, follow our artistic, I guess, desires versus what actually will sell. I think you've got to find a sweet spot in the middle there. With my work, what I found was that when I had something more representational in my work, I found that it sold more. So if I had imagery of some kind, some botanical imagery and things like that, but I felt a desire within myself to paint more abstract, to get away from the imagery. And so I had to kind of find a sweet spot in between those two. And so what's happened is I still have some elements, but over time I'm sort of letting them go. So my work is becoming more abstract, kind of slowly in a sense. What I am working on is bringing the sense of that, those things that used to inspire me, so the trees and the nature, inspiration, it's still in my paintings, but I'm expressing it in a more abstract way. And in many ways, I'm bringing my audience on a journey with me.
The way I see it is that you never really create something for a profit. You create it because you love creating.
That's right. And to me, I needed to evolve my art so that I was still happy and enjoying the process. I feel like art that is created from that place is always going to have a different kind of energy, and it will attract an audience if you are creating from that place of joy.
If you're creating for money, you're not going to have a long career. You know, you have to be doing it because you love it. And then the money or the commercial aspect is secondary.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about, you know, if you are broke. I'm just trying to think about, what do you do?
Well, you get a job.
Yeah.
You work part-time. You substitute your art.
Yeah.
With a job. Like, all creatives do this. This isn't something that's unique to artists. Like photographers, songwriters, singers, bands. They all work jobs until they make their breakthrough. Or they don't. But the one thing you will have left is the love of the art. Whether you make it big or you make money on it or not, will you still be creating art? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. I think you have to value your artistic practice over and above making a profit. Your idea around having like a part-time job that supports you as you develop your art, I think that's a really good one.
Ida Secker, 18, would like to know if you still have pieces in between that you toss out because you aren't satisfied with them.
Yes, absolutely. That's my short answer. Over the weekend, I was cleaning out my studio, getting it ready for the next kind of phase of creative work. And as I was going through it, I was thinking to myself, wow, there is a lot of rubbish in here. And recently, I have been working on letting go of perfection and creating art in short spaces of time. That has resulted in a loosening up and some breakthroughs, but it has also produced a whole lot of rubbish. So the answer is yes. And those pieces will be going either in the recycling bin, or I'll be tearing them up, using them for collage or something like that. But they are rubbish in their current state.
They are rubbish. Sac Fluid Art would like to know, what are some of your challenges when starting your art journey?
I think one of the things that I found challenging, and I hear many artists say this, is that I wanted to do it all. There's so many things to choose from, and I was overwhelmed with possibilities. It was a good problem to have, but I found myself going, ooh, I want to paint the landscape. Ooh, maybe I should learn how to paint portraits. Ooh, collage sounds fun. Maybe I should do something in monochrome. And I found myself jumping around a lot, and it was only later on that I started to bring parameters into my work. And I started doing things like limiting my palette, making art in a series. So choosing something and sticking with it and lingering for a while. When I started to do that, my art improved and also my enjoyment of the process, because I was really able to go deeper and discover things about my materials, learn about composition, color. So yes, I had the challenge of too many options at the beginning. The other big one was the gap between what I wanted to create and what I was capable of creating with the skills that I had at the time when I began. So there's a whole lot of education that needed to happen. And it was frustrating because I wanted to be able to paint at a level that I didn't yet have the tools, the skills, the experience to do. That was a challenge in the early days of my journey. Thankfully, over time and with a lot of practice, that gap has become a lot smaller. There's still a gap. There's still definitely artists that I look at and go, wow, you know, I'd love to get myself to that level. I believe that will always be the case. And I will continue to be evolving and challenging myself. But they were the two areas. Too many possibilities and the skill gap.
Good boy Griff would like to know, how do you get over the pressure to create something great each time?
This is something I've been working on a lot recently. And I mentioned it before about doing things like getting into my studio and creating art in a short space of time. I guess there's a whole lot of strategies that you can employ to encourage this loosening up, letting go of perfection, which is very valuable and powerful for your art. So I've tried to do things like work in a sketchbook or work on paper because it takes the pressure off. Set yourself a timer, paint for 10 minutes, let it be whatever it needs to be. Use colors that you don't like. These sorts of things can help you to get over that feeling like everything has to be fantastic, everything has to be finished. I create a lot of work without focusing on the finishing stage. So I go into my studio and I allow the process to motivate me. And then when I get to the end of it, I just move on and paint something else. I don't spend ages thinking about the finishing. And when I go into my studio, there's all these pieces that are in varying stages. And when I come back to them over time, quite a lot of those pieces that I thought weren't finished were finished. So that I find very useful. Painting a lot of art is another one, because we feel a lot of pressure when we put all our eggs in one basket. So if we're working on one piece, it becomes our baby that we worry about. Whereas if you have loads of babies, not to say you wouldn't worry about all your babies if you had loads of babies, but if you've got loads of pieces of art going on, you can bounce from one to the other and it allows a lot of freedom in your work. So they're just a few ideas that you might want to try to let go of some of the pressure of creating a perfect piece.
Manish Infinity would like to know how to handle days when you just don't feel like painting. How to know it's not fear or self-sabotage. This sounds very familiar.
Yeah, well, we did an episode actually about fear and procrastination and how that shows up. And that is actually one of my favourite episodes that we've ever done. So what episode number is that one?
I think that was 56.
Yeah, so I definitely recommend listening to that, because that is about when it is fear and self-sabotage showing up. I do recognise that there are days when you just don't feel like painting and nothing is going to get you in the mood. It's counterproductive. You might try for a little bit and then you're just not feeling it.
Yeah, I think in the podcast you suggest going and doing something else on the business. So do your bookwork or whatever. Me personally, I think getting out. Going for a walk.
Yeah.
You know, I think you should always have the capacity to go for a walk or get out into the nature as a backup plan for anything.
Generally, because you don't really know what's going on. When you don't feel like painting, it's hard to know whether it's you're procrastinating, you're scared, or whether you're just feeling flat and not in the mood. So what I would tend to do is go into my studio and give it a shot. And I've made myself do that many times. I've kind of dragged myself in there, just sit down, just do something for 20 minutes or so, see what happens. If I still don't feel it, generally there's something going on with me. You know, I'm feeling flat, I've got other pressures, maybe I'm worrying about something. And in that case, what you suggested about going for a walk is going to be very helpful. So my suggestion is give it a go. If it's not happening, it's not happening. Let yourself off the hook. Go and do something else. Feed your soul in other ways and come back at it again tomorrow. You do need to keep showing up, but you also need to show yourself some compassion as well.
Ida Seeker, 18, would like to know, how long did it take you to produce art you're happy with?
This is an interesting one too. When I first started painting, I created some pieces that I was super happy with at the time. I was amazed at what could happen with paint and I was excited. I showed you some things that now if I looked at them, I would be like, what was I thinking? But I was super proud of them. So I think I started creating work that I was happy with quite early on in the painting process. I don't know, I feel like I'm going to contradict myself here because I talked about that skill gap before. There definitely was, as I became more aware and I started seeing other things out there. So I was quite naive when I started. And then I started looking on Instagram and seeing other artists and suddenly I realized, oh, I'm not very good.
Devastated.
And I realized that I had a long way to go. And then there was a frustrating period of trying to figure out what I was doing, what kind of style of art I liked. And there were some hard painting days in there, like really frustrating days. It took several years of practice to get to a point where I felt more consistently happy with my work. The other thing that's happened, and it ties in with what I just spoke about, is I've become more compassionate about my work and more accepting of the range of work that you need to create in order to produce that happy painting. So I might need to paint 10 pieces of rubbish in order to get to one piece that I really love. And now more accepting of that. There is definitely more consistency with it and you will get more proficient over time and be able to produce paintings that you're happier with on a more regular basis with practice. It's just like with anything, practice, practice, practice.
Would you always go back to the process, loving the process first and the result being secondary?
I think like with many of these things, it's the mindset game that is the hard part. And letting go of the outcome, really enjoying the process, it provides you with so much more enjoyment. So you could have, when you think about it, a happy painting may not be about the end result. It's about how you felt while you were painting it, the fun of it, the freedom of it. So I think now one of the things is I can be happier with work for different reasons. I can see something and go, wow, that pushed me in a different direction. That I was a lot bolder with that. I tried something new. I'm happy with that because, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm looking at my work in a different way. I'm not just looking at it as, is this a good finished product? I'm looking at it for what it is gifting me in the process.
Viola Vanderin would like to know, which other artists inspire you?
There's so many. I'm just trying to think, like there's current artists that inspire me, but then there's also like going back into history. So I studied art at high school, didn't go to art school, but loved it, did it up to year 12. And we studied art history and I found this so enjoyable just to dig in deep with all the different movements. And one of the movements that I was very inspired by was Fauvism. And I've always loved like Van Gogh and Matisse. And just because to me, it was so exciting what they did, like the way that they moved away from realism, like the classical painters and the impressionists as well were wonderful in what they did. So history-wise, definitely like Van Gogh and Matisse are two of my favourites. At the moment, I mean, there's so many brilliant artists and I see them on Instagram and things like that. I've had several of them on the podcast, so I get the opportunity to ask artists that I have crushes on to come and speak with us. So we had Amica Wincop on the podcast recently. I have a big crush on her work. She also loves fluid paint and she just does amazing things with the materials. Andrea Sue's big fan of her work. Other artists that I love Lola Donoghue in Ireland, you know, the artist with the sheep. No, she's a beautiful studio and you can always see sheep in the background. And with Richie being from Ireland, sometimes I have a little chat about Lola. I'm just going to mention a couple of artists over on Instagram that I've been enjoying. Elaine Spafford is one and Beth Winterburn is another one that I have been recently enjoying following their journey. So look those ones up if you're interested.
Jamila Studio is asking, how would you describe abstract art to someone who does not understand it?
Like you.
Me.
How would I describe it? I'm going to try and describe it in a Laura way rather than in a art school kind of way. So I would describe abstract art as really shifting away from accurately representing what you see, and it's more about how you feel and leaving space for the viewer to kind of put their own, I guess, emotions onto a piece. And to do that with abstract art, the elements of art become kind of more important than a thing as such. So color, texture, line, it sort of emphasizes those things and the process of making art, rather than the idea of painting a portrait and accurately depicting what someone looks like. Do you get what I mean?
I understand exactly what you mean.
So that's how I would describe it. You're really getting away from accurate representation, which is why we often talk about abstract art being non-representational.
Ilaria Spadoni wants more info about your courses.
Well, that's an easy one to answer. If you hop over to my website, laurahornart.com/classes, you'll be able to see all of the classes that I offer. There are 9 classes at the moment, and they vary from watercolor to acrylic. They've all sort of got a bit of a mixed media element. There's some collage in there. I'll let you go over there and have a look. They all have a class trailer. So I would always suggest, if you're not sure what class to go for, to watch the trailers, because they give a great feel for the class. Anything that is in the trailer is footage from the class. So you'll be able to see that painting come to life in the videos that are included in the classes. So these are all online classes. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for submitting your questions. I'm sorry we didn't quite get through them all, but we really appreciate them and we'll see what else we can cover in future podcasts. Also, we are answering some more questions in our vlog this week. That's right, the vlog is back and we are chatting about some of the questions that came up in our latest online class, Abstract Landscapes. So if you want to check that out, head on over to the show notes. It'll be linked there, but you can also check out all the vlogs over on our website if you go to laurahornart.com/vlogs.